Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman, brought to you by globalresearch.ca. And we're back on a very important topic. Needless to say, we have discussions on it all the time on this program, and I'm delighted to have back on Bill Engdahl to talk about the global economic crisis, collapse, calamity, catastrophe. I think we can give it a lot of names, Bill, but let me tell listeners who may not know who you are, I think most do, because you're a regular on the program, but some who don't, let me just tell them that you're a leading researcher, economist, an analyst of the New World Order. You've done this for over 30 years, writing on energy, on politics, on economics, and so much more, Bill. When I see your articles on global research, I practically drop everything and read them. Either that or as soon as I get a break in what I'm doing, I come to read what you have because it's such vital stuff. Let me tell listeners about your two books and your new one. Your earlier one, The A Century of War, Anglo-American Politics and the New World Order, and your newer one, before your latest, Seeds of Destruction, The Hidden Agenda of Genetic Manipulation, both must reading. And your newest one, and I'll let you tell me if it's out. I thought it was out last time you came on. Hopefully it's either out or pretty close to it now, Bill. Full Spectrum Dominance, Totalitarian Democracy in the New World Order. Is it out yet, Bill?
It's due out, hopefully, at the end of April. There have been some production delays, but things are moving ahead now, and I expect it out by end of April at latest.
Well, that'll give me an excuse to get you back so we can talk about it again. This is like a serial, Bill. We keep breaking off at a key moment, and people are hanging with bated breath. They can't wait to come back and hear the next episode. So we'll give them another episode, but maybe we can concentrate on the global economic crisis, which certainly isn't getting better. Stock markets or no stock markets. But we lost the archive of the last program. So I got emails from people very disappointed they missed the live program, and I promised them I'd get you back. So let's go over what's happening and discuss just exactly how bad this is.
It's potentially, it could be much less bad than it is right now. The problem we have is that the so-called economic team of the current president, Obama, are the people responsible for creating the framework for this mess in the first place back in the past several years. I'm speaking most particularly about Larry Summers, the White House economic council head, who was Treasury Secretary under the Clinton administration in 99 and year 2000, and precisely was a driving force behind the financial market deregulation that created the basis for the banks to do what they've done. And Summers was a key point man in the administration for passage of the Commodity Futures Modernization Act in 2000. He was a key point person to help his former boss, who went on to Citigroup as vice chairman after he left Treasury, and speaking of Robert Rubin, in the removal of the restrictions of the Glass-Steagall Act of 1933. Those two single things laid the basis more than anything else for what we are suffering through today.
Bill, we need to break. Let's do that.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Talking about the global economic crisis. Oh, those retreads indeed, Bill, the Clinton-esque retreads, Summers, all the proteges of Robert Rubin, and the only missing piece, the only key missing piece is Alan Greenspan, but his alter ego, as it turns out, replaced him, Ben Bernanke, hardly missing a beat.
Yeah.
And then Greenspan, by the way, I don't know whether you noticed or heard about it, about a week ago, he did an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal saying the Fed didn't cause the housing bubble. who do they think caused it? The tooth fairy? I mean, my goodness.
Well, let me say something to that, Stephen. The Greenspan, as chairman of the Fed from day one in August of 1987, was lobbying the Congress of the United States to repeal Glass-Steagall. And when Glass-Steagall finally was repealed in 1999, after the Wall Street Bank spent literally hundreds of millions of dollars in lobbying fee and who knows what that all went for, not just bottles of champagne, we can be sure, that the Alan Greenspan celebrated the event as a great step forward. Greenspan encouraged this housing debacle, encouraged the securitization, which he called the financial revolution, the revolution in finance. This man, to call him a hypocrite is being overly charitable. This man is a liar. This man is an outright liar who shouldn't be benighted as Sir Alan Greenspan. He should be imprisoned as a financial criminal.
Well, Bill, you're taking the words out of my mouth. He's not only a liar, he's a criminal. And I was just about to say that that this is a man who never saw a regulation he didn't want to repeal, and indeed Glass-Steagall and all the rest.
Yeah.
And even when he had flack from the other governors on the Federal Reserve Board, when they got into discussions about things getting out of hand and so on, he just swept them aside and said, well, you know, the market will take care of this.
Yeah.
He didn't even want to hear about it. Now, why the other guys on that board didn't have the gumption to go up against him and just vote him down, but of course they never did it.
Yeah. That says it all right there. A bunch of spineless rubber stamps that were chosen for that reason. No,
so
this
here
was
we
Wall
are.
Street's. A lot of people forget the basic point about the Federal Reserve, and that is this is not a government agency.
Indeed.
My dear fellow Americans, this is a private organization controlled for profit by the private banking interests of the United States and allied parts of that. The Hank Greenberg, when he was chairman of the AIG group back 10, 12 years ago, sat on the board of the New York Federal Reserve Bank, a private stockholding company. The Federal Reserve system of 12 regional reserve banks is simply the umbrella that gives the veneer of public interest, but this has nothing to do with the public interest. This is a private cabal of the Wall Street money trust, as it used to be called in the Congress.
And, of course, the Fed, or anything to do with the U.S., really, the power, the effects, good or bad, resonate globally. So if we have good times, then good times spread elsewhere in the world. And if we have bad times or calamitous times, terrible times, then we spread that toxicity around the world, and it's pretty tough to escape from it.
Yeah,
so
that's because the U.S., after Bretton Woods in 1944, built a system where the financial power of Wall Street would replace London as the center of the American system. They called it the American century back then. Didn't even last 100 years. But the centerpiece is control of world capital flows, control of world finance with the dollar as reserve currency. And through that mechanism, as it's said often in Europe, when the U.S. gets a cold, the rest of the world sneezes.
And as you've written, Bill, back it up with the world's strongest military.
Yeah.
I mean, if anybody gets out
of
line.
Well, that's all it has, backing it up right now. It doesn't have an economy anymore. Tragically about it.
Indeed. Well, you intrigue me. I mean, let's talk about the problems, but you intrigue me with your opening statement that just maybe things might not be as bad. What makes you think that?
I want to put out the prospect for listeners to realize how simple it would be to begin to reverse the direction of all this and reduce the power of this Wall Street financial cabal down to a manageable size where the real economy could begin to reassert itself. It won't as long as that's not done. But it would be as simple as this. The father of derivatives, Myron Scholes, who got a Nobel Prize for it, the whole tells you how much the Nobel Prize in economics is worth, but be that as it may, Myron Scholes has a little bit of perspective on the question of derivatives. He gave a speech at the Stern School at NYU, I think it was about a week ago, where he said, this has gotten, the use of derivatives for pure speculative purposes has gotten totally out of control of what I and Fisher Black intended when we came up with the theory back in the 70s. And the only thing that can be done to restore the economy to its rightful balance is to blow up the credit default swap and other derivative market stock options and so forth. Just blow it up and then declare that there will be no money or a minimal amount of money paid on those contracts, these trillions of dollars of contracts, in nominal value, not in net value. And then the government would regulate these things and put them on exchanges where they can be traded in an orderly way. That's exactly what Larry Summers ran, if you will, back in 2000 when he backed the Commodity Futures Monetization Act. That allowed futures, financial futures, to be traded off exchange between banks, between counterparties, with absolutely no regulation. This is tantamount to financial and fiscal or prudential insanity on the part of the government and the Congress.
Now, if you blow them up, Bill, what does that do to the holders of these derivatives? They take the losses fully?
Yeah, like Goldman Sachs, Deutsche Bank, Morgan Stanley, Citigroup, J.P. Morgan Chase, they would have to swallow the losses.
Well, that
that's,
who
the counterparties
right?
are. This was a casino, and there were only about 10 or 15 big players worldwide in this credit default swap market. That's the criminal thing about it. Nobody. Why do you think, Stephen, that the government was so reluctant, Treasury Secretary Geithner was so reluctant to reveal the counterparties that were being paid with taxpayer monies through AIG for their derivative exposures with contracts on credit default swaps with AIG?
But now we know.
Insurance policy.
Now
well,
we know.
You know the tip of the iceberg, but that's exactly the names that came out.
With Goldman Sachs
at all.
Goldman Sachs at the head of the list, Bill, $13 billion.
Yeah, that's probably not the full story even there.
Oh, I bet it's not the full story. Of course, Paulson cut the deal, former head of Goldman Sachs, $13 billion, his own money on the line, apparently a lot of it. So the deal was cut, the billions go to Goldman Sachs. I have a feeling, Bill, who can know, but AIG is a dead insurance company walking. I have a feeling that once all the counterparties, the big ones, are satisfied, they may either let it die or break it up into salvageable pieces, let the dead parts die, and AIG at some point no longer will exist.
Well, the madness, the insanity of this whole thing, and it was pre-programmed that there wouldn't be anything fundamentally changed from the Paulson formula. When Obama picked his team, look at who's on it. Larry Summers, who created the mess back in 2000. You have Tim Geithner, who gave the yes to the lack of a government rescue for Lehman Brothers, and that was the event, the default event, that triggered the global systemic crisis back in September last year. And Paul Volcker, the man responsible for the Volcker shock therapy back in 79 and 82 that created the third world Latin American, et cetera, debt crisis. So you've got not just the fox guarding the hen house, you've got the wolves guarding the hen house in this financial team, and there's no way in the world they're going to act against the interests that they've supported their entire professional lives.
So what you're saying is there are solutions to this if people adopt the right policies, but what they're doing is they're doing exactly the opposite of that. So they're throwing fuel on the fire, and they're building a bigger fire. And they may bail out their big players, the Goldman Sachs or whatever.
That's the point of it all. That's the simple point of it all.
Oh, yeah.
That's the simple point. The it's like putting fertilizer on a dead tree. This is absolutely to throw government money at AIG and these institutions, Citigroup, Bank of America, and so forth. It's like putting fertilizer on a dead tree. And this is absolutely a violation of the government's trust to respect the general interest, the general welfare of the nation. They're acting in the interest of a criminal cabal of financial interests. And there's no other word. There's no nice, polite word that can be used for this. It's the criminal cabal of financial interests that have used money to corrupt the political process in the United States of America especially over the last 15 years when these securitized instruments exploded. And now that has to be either brought under control with rigorous methods, or the entire United States economy and much of the world will go down with it.
Bill, you've written in the past that there could be a plot involved in stuff like this to literally crush economies, crush businesses, cut their stock prices to a fraction of what they reached when they were prosperous. The idea being to let, say, big U.S. banks buy up assets on the cheap. This is the way they can go out and plunder the competition or buy businesses like the auto giants for pennies on the dollar.
Yeah. I think this was the idea of many of the people in the major banks and financial houses like Goldman originally, that they thought through the spread of these securitized assets globally, we would get sovereign wealth funds in China, in the Persian Gulf, the Emirates, and so forth, to buy into this toxic waste without knowing what they're doing, because they thought it was AAA rated by Moody's and so on. And once they get a certain volume of that, then they would say, okay, you got to bail us out, or you go under with us.
So we need to break again.
This is RVN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm on with Bill Engdahl. Bill, I want to mention your book, A Century of War, again. And, do I urge that listeners get hold of that book. It'll teach them so much history that explains so much about what's going on now. Tell listeners what we did to Japan in the 1980s that ended up causing their two lost decades, and what we did to East Asia in 1997-98. I mean, knocking them down, East Asia, my goodness, to waltz in there and open up their markets that were closed to buy assets on the cheap. And was it the Paris Accords in the 1980s that changed what Japan did with its currency and its interest rates?
The Plaza Accord, yeah. The Asia crisis, I think, is the clearest example. The Japan one came a little bit before, but back in 1997, actually a little bit before 1997, the U.S. Treasury put massive pressure on, back then they were called the tiger economies, the Asian tiger economies, because South Korea, Thailand, Malaysia, a number of these economies, and to an extent Indonesia, had managed to get double-digit growth rates without recourse to IMF conditionalities, without recourse to foreign borrowing. They'd done it on, these are high savings, like China today, very high savings rate economies in terms of culture. So at that point, I think there was a decision made in Washington and in Wall Street that the existence of those tiger economies was a real potential threat to the United States, because they wanted to promote the free market model, Milton Friedman, anything goes model that we see destroying everything today. So a number of hedge funds were instrumentalized to do the job. The George Soros Quantum Fund, together with More Capital Management, and the third one was called the Tiger and Jaguar Funds of Julian Robertson. It's no longer around. I think he retired afterwards. And they were given, as best can be ascertained, they were given open credit lines by Citibank, by J.P. Morgan. It wasn't yet merged with Chase, by Chase and the major Wall Street players, these offshore derivatives, hedge funds rather. And what they would do is gang up on the weakest economy first, and that was Thailand. First of all, they built up the bubble. The Treasury demanded that these economies open up their capital markets to foreign investment, free flow of capital in and out. So when they opened up, then came these foreign hedge funds and started investing in the stock market. They started playing the stock market. Well, of course, that started shooting the stock prices up, because if you come in with $1 billion in the Bangkok stock market, you're just exploding everything on the block upwards. And that's exactly what happened. So then the Thai money started piling in behind them. And once the bubble got built up, you had wild real estate speculation, luxury apartments and hotels going up everywhere. The then Soros and company simply pulled the plug. Mahathir was very, very explicit about this at the time and hit the nail right on the head by naming names. But they then pulled their money out, and they made a play that the currency couldn't withstand the pressures that they would put on it, and that the interest rates would have to go sky high. So they made money on both ends of the thing and literally collapsed the economies, paving the way for Larry Summers, who was then Deputy Treasury Secretary, and Robert Rubin to demand that the IMF come in and bail these countries out. Well, that's what happened. They had, it went on until 1998, the so-called Asia crisis. It was manufactured in New York by the Wall Street banks and by Washington, by the Treasury. And the aim was to destroy the Tiger model. Well, they did a pretty good job of that, not complete. But what happened as a result of that is global capital flows made a 180-degree direction shift. And you had outflows of capital from trade surpluses in South Korea and so forth after 98, 99, 2000, and so forth, into the United States economy, into U.S. Government bonds, because the central banks wanted to build up an emergency fund, a currency reserve fund in U.S. government bonds to protect against the next possible attack. And that's exactly what Summers and company wanted. They wanted to have this huge inflow of capital to bring U.S. interest rates down and create the Clinton economic miracle. And this is the kind of dirty pool that is consistently the pattern ever since the emergence of J.P. Morgan back in the 19th century.
Well, Bill, I think the same thing may be going on now, this time on a much bigger scale than just East Asia or Japan. But, this contagion has spread everywhere.
If I can interject there, Stephen, I think that was the intent, and I think it's run amok.
Oh, I think it has run amok.
Yeah, and that definitely, I'm convinced, was the intent. And that was the finance and the military power are the two pillars of American power projection since the post-war period. And now the financial power as a result of the mishandling of this mess and the fact that the rest of the world was a little bit more hesitant than they had hoped means that they are really in deep, deep, deep trouble.
And, well, I think they wanted a crisis, Bill, but I don't think they wanted it quite as bad as this.
I don't think
become.
They gambled on it getting this out of control and the fact that the rest of the world wouldn't just buckle under to their wishes. I think they're living a little bit in a dream world of past glory, and that's the problem with these elites.
It's a dirty, dirty piece of business. Oh, there's so much more to talk about, Bill. We'll cover as much as we can in the hour, but we have to break again. Let's do it, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the News Hour. We're on with Bill Engdahl. Bill, again, I want to stress that, and I want to go back to what we talked about in the last program that I'm afraid is an archive, so maybe I can get you to repeat it again. On the flak that the powers in Washington and Wall Street are getting from the EU, from China, from Russia. But I want to stress again, if listeners want to know the historical perspective that I've never read anyplace else, Bill, then they need to get a copy of your book, A Century of War. And I imagine it's simple to go to Amazon and order a copy.
Mm-hmm.
And they will understand what they'll never get in the mainstream. And then they can see the broad picture. This is not something new. This has happened before. And now we're doing it again on a global scale. But last time we talked a little bit about how the EU, I think especially, isn't too pleased with what Washington is doing. And they have their own ideas. Go into that again.
Well, the EU response, there is no EU response as such. That's one of the problems there. Our various national responses. You have basket case countries that went along with the Anglo-Saxon model on financialization over the last 10 years, namely Ireland. Ireland is just over the top in terms of toxic waste debts in the banking system. And then you have the UK, Great Britain, which imitated everything that Wall Street did wrong. And that's going to be by far the most severely hit economy in the EU. Then you have Italy. Italy is a country. It's not really a country anymore. It's an outpost of the, I don't know what you want to call it, the Cosa Nostra or organized crime. The prime minister, literally, it's documented in books that have been published but aren't available in Italy, that the Berlusconi government is literally the mafia brought into the political arena. So they're in a state of denial about the existence of any crisis at all. Berlusconi's response when banks come to him and say, Mr. Prime Minister, this is real, this is serious, we have to do something. Oh, shut up and don't talk about it. It'll just spread demoralization among the population. So talk about a state of denial. On the other side, you have countries like Germany, where there are real problems in Germany, especially in the auto sector. But the old mandarins of the civil service at the Bundesbank, the central bank, and also in the finance ministry have a little bit of a grip on reality and aren't about to go along with the kind of bailout schemes that that Keitner and Larry Summers are hoping for.
So basically what we talked about last time was Washington wants one size fits all, their way, and everybody accepts it and goes the way that Washington is going. And in the EU, the countries have their own problems and they want to find their own solutions.
You know, basically, it amounts to that Washington wants the rest of the world to bail out the Wall Street system and keep it running. And like I said earlier, it's like throwing fertilizer on a dead tree. And the Europeans are saying, wait a minute, we have better uses for our fertilizer. We can create, save jobs here in Germany and France and the rest of Europe with that money and not bail out banks that are simply going to use it to make more casino speculation. This is, you know, the whole problem of AIG is nothing more or less than a giant lottery game that the big banks like Goldman Sachs and Citigroup played with AIG as the counterparty, insurance. And once that's realized, the problem becomes extremely simple. It's a political act. The President of the United States writes an executive order. The Congress approves a new law abrogating the Commodity Futures Modernization Act of 2000, and says commodities, especially financial commodities, from here forth must be traded on regulated exchanges, and there are no exceptions. Any other contracts entered into are null and void and will not be honored in any court of law in the United States. And overnight, you would have a cleaning up of the volatility in the financial markets. The banks, this is the nux of the thing. The crux of the thing is that the banks, as a result of that, would be cut down to size. These Goliaths that have been created, Citigroup, at the repeal of Glass-Steagall, became a $2.2 trillion. I want to emphasize that trillion. That's one with a hell of a lot of zeros after it. $2.2 trillion bank in terms of nominal assets. That's because it merged and bought everything in sight using dodgy financial paper as collateral. And that has to be brought down to reality. These institutions, they're not too big to fail. They're too big to save. AIG is too big to save. So let's not save it. Nationalize it. Bring the debts, you know, put it through a Chapter 11. This isn't such a radical thing that we're talking about. We're talking about it for General Motors. Let's put the banks through a Chapter 11 right now before we waste any more money. Very simple.
Oh, indeed. Of course, they won't do that. And my idea of a bank is for a bank to be a bank, not to be a casino, not to be a hedge fund, and certainly not to commit massive fraud. And think of the damage these people have done to millions of savers in the country. People, of course, losing their homes, sold these terrible mortgages. But aside from that, I mean, the calamity that's facing people, even people that bought good mortgages, you lose your job. Too many people in the U.S., we have a culture of non-saving. Now, that's changing because people don't have a choice. They're maxed out. And you can't spend what you don't have, or you can't borrow So people have reached the end of the chain.
Yeah.
So good people live, say, one paycheck away from personal insolvency. People lose a job, Bill. And I've had people on this program, John Williams, economist John Williams, Jack Ramses,
good friend of mine,
saying
yeah.
that John Williams, your friend, saying that we haven't lost 600,000 jobs a month. We've lost maybe 800,000 to a million a month going
yeah.
back at least to November,
mm-hmm.
and nobody sees an end to this thing. Jack
mm-hmm.
Rasmus will be back on the program on Friday. We'll
mm-hmm.
talk about this again. He's got some new writing. I mean, good people, honest people, hardworking, are getting into terrible, terrible financial trouble through no fault of their own. And these banks are the criminals that cause this problem. I don't even
yep.
like calling them banks, Bill, because they certainly don't function like banks. When they want to fool the public, they declare an operating profit. I guess they're normal lending operations, and they're getting free money now. Because interest rates are at zero, aside from the handouts to them, they're getting zero interest rate to money, and they're loaning it out for whatever they can get. So it's real easy to make a profit on that kind of at that end of the business. But in the case of Citigroup, there's no mention about the $37 trillion in derivatives on their books, and who knows what percent of that is toxic.
Yep.
But they forget about that,
yep.
and they don't write it down. So everything is fine. And the bank is doing just great again. And the same with Bank of America, maybe the others. And then we discover, Bill, that I mentioned in my last article on The Economy, that official filings showed that at least four top Citigroup executives bought the company stock. Two of them I mentioned at about $1.25 a share. I think yesterday Citigroup closed at about $2.50. I mean, these people scammed the system. Now, this was before the Pandit memo came out that for the first 2 months of the year, Citigroup was profitable for the first time since 2007. Well, whoopee, the stock market rallied 1,000 points or so.
Uh-huh.
I mean, these banks are still insolvent, which I guess is a kind way of saying the bank.
100%. Now watch the insider trading when they get rid of that. Before.
they could be dumping them as we speak.
Well,
in a few trading days... Oh, a man who was a director, apparently a director and not an officer of the company, not an employee of the company, had made $1.7 million. He bought it $1.25 a share. I forget his name. It's in my article, my last article on The Economy. $1.25 a share. And after a few trading days, he had made $1.7 million.
Yes.
Now, if we had that kind of information, Bill, we could do very nicely for ourselves.
Well, you have to, it's who you know.
That's
who you know, and that's the problem.
This is
the real crony capitalism. You know, Larry Summers used to blame the Asians and say the cause of the Asian crisis, lying through his teeth, was crony capitalism. Well, this is the real crony capitalism. This is all insider dealings without end. Wall Street protecting its own as though they were an endangered species. Let's hope they are. In terms of their ability to maintain that kind of a system. But I think we ought to get used to calling them, instead of calling these particular institutions, I'm talking about the 10 or 15 largest financial institutions, from Goldman Sachs to Citigroup to Morgan Chase and so forth, Bank of America. I think we shouldn't refer to them as banks. We should refer to them as what they are, gambling casinos, unregulated gambling casinos.
And dare I say, Bill, on top of that, let's just lump them all together and refer to Wall Street as a crime syndicate. I think that's basically what it is. But here's the key point.
There are a few honest people trying to eke out a living in Wall Street.
Oh, indeed, but they're not the
minority.
Ones.
They're
not the ones who do the inside of trading, Bill. Sit in the boardrooms and come up with all of this knavery and thievery and the rest of it. But here's the key thing that I think people want to hear. Let's assume that the same toxic policies will continue, and I don't think you and I have any reason to think that Washington/Wall Street won't continue doing what they're doing now. What do you see going ahead for the global economy? It looks like pretty rough going to me.
I think it's going to be very rough going for the U.S. economy. And I've said this before on the show, Stephen. I think we're looking at 10 years of hell. For the global economy, it's differentiated. The British economy is probably looking at pretty much the same thing. Spain, maybe only a little bit less so. Italy is a basket case. Ireland is a disaster. Germany and France and kind of the core of the industrial European Union economies will probably come through this relatively okay because they have the infrastructure, they have the modern industry. They haven't outsourced all their industry the way the U.S. has over the last 15 years, so they have something to work with. And there's still an inherent conservatism in places like Germany and France. So they're talking about the revival of the French model and dirigism and things like that. But China, you have to look at China as a very special case. And there, I think we're going to be surprised in perhaps 6 months to a year's time that China could well come out of this, given how effectively they implement the decisions they've already made at the highest level, that they could come out of this economically stronger than they went into it. And that, of course, is not the kind of result that Wall Street wanted to see. One reason Paulson was Treasury Secretary was because of his ties as chairman of Goldman Sachs, his ties to China. They counted on him persuading the Chinese to simply walk along behind Wall Street and the bond markets. And China is speaking very clearly in the last months in bilateral discussions, saying, okay, Mr. President Obama, I want you to give us assurance that the investments of the Chinese central bank in U.S. Treasury debt in the debt of the United States government is a safe investment. That means, what steps are you taking to control the size of your deficit? And all that Obama and the U.S. authorities could answer is, oh, you can bet on the safety of United States government bonds. Well, that's no longer the case. This is a debt that's probably going to reach, in terms of GDP, 100% of GDP by the end of this year or early next year. I mean, that is a staggering explosion of public debt in the United States. Everybody says, well, it's under control because the European Union has an average of 65 to 70%. Well, U.S. goes to 100%, but it's the largest economy in the world. So you're talking about huge numbers here, and who's going to finance that debt? Well, the Chinese are increasingly clear that they're not willing to throw good money after bad anymore. And Japan is choking in its own homemade problems. So that leaves the two biggest sources. And what are the Gulf Arab countries going to do? Are they so excited about the U.S. policy toward the Arab world after 9/11 that they're going to throw their money into the United States to bail out the U.S. bond market? I don't think so.
In the case of China and Japan, Bill, they're the biggest sovereign owners of U.S. treasuries.
And China by far, much more.
China by far. I guess nobody knows the exact.
Well, it's a state classified information for a number of reasons, but the estimates are that based on the portfolio of their trade exposures, China has about 70% of, they have a total of $2 trillion in foreign reserves in the central bank, and perhaps 70% of that, or $1.4 trillion, is held in Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, or direct U.S. Treasury bills or bonds.
So what do they do? Simply slow down their purchases, or do they
stop? I think they'll try to be as conservative as possible and slow down the rate of new purchases and not sell off the existing purchases they have, but that alone would be enough to push U.S. interest rates up.
A big question I have is what in the end will happen to Fannie and Freddie a year, 5 years from now? Will they even exist?
Nobody can tell at the rate they're going. Yeah.
I mean, if the government hadn't taken them over, they're goners. Is it possible that no matter what the government does, it won't be enough to save them?
I just don't want to take a stand on that right now.
It might make more sense, Bill, instead of having a couple of big ones, to have a lot of little ones.
Mm.
Maybe there'll be some, or maybe they would break them up into pieces. And instead of Freddie, we have little Freddies.
Yeah. Well, the government owns them, so they ought to reorganize them in a way that makes sense, but that's not being done. All of these bank bailouts are being done with a hands-off policy. Leave the existing administration in control. Leave the people who created the problem there. Don't touch them. A few of them have run for cover, like Robert Rubin took a retirement at the turn of the year just to get out of the line of fire. But for the most part, they're still sitting at their desks. And that's just unbelievable. In Sweden, when they had this crisis back in the early 90s, 91, 92, the government nationalized banks that that were insolvent and created a state agency called Securum, took all the bad real estate assets of the banks and put them into this state corporation called Securum. And that left a bank with basically consumer loans, small business loans, and so forth, that could function as a normal bank. And slowly, after 4 or 5 years, the real estate market came back in Sweden, and they were able to reprivatize these banks, and the economy. Those banks are among the healthiest in Europe today.
A real workable system that we could do, and we have the same result, but we refuse to do it.
Yeah.
So we need to break again. Let's do that, and then we'll have a final segment. Let me just mention one more thing. The other side of the coin, the policy coming out of Washington, the fiscal side, and I was so struck with what Michel wrote in his most recent article on The Economy, where he talks about the Obama fiscal program being a mammoth austerity program. He talks about the most drastic curtailment of public spending in American history. Mm-hmm. And the reason being that the money is being directed mainly in three areas, to bail out Wall Street, the big banks, to the military complex, the defense contractors, and all the others that profit along with them.
Right.
And the other big chunk to service the federal debt, approaching something on the order of $500 billion a year. So what on earth are you going to spend to help people in need? I mean, there isn't very much left.
Exactly. And, of course, that's all being projected against absolutely fairy tale projections of growth for the economy after the end of this year. So all the numbers are just not worth the paper that they're printed on or the computer space that they take up.
Well, I'm always struck by a quote I haven't used for a good while, but I shall mention it a few times in the past. The great muckraking journalist I.F. Stone, who died about 20 years ago, he used to give lectures to young journalism students, and his signature line was to say, and he said it two ways, but the short way was simply to tell them, make sure they understood it, that all governments lie. All governments lie, and the rest of it was that nothing they say should be believed. So Obama comes on and says everything is fine, we have good policies in place, we're fixing things. Well, he's a bloody liar. They're all bloody liars, and we need to expose them for what they are, because people are being hurt. They're really being hurt badly, and I'm in my mid-70s, Bill. I mean, I look back decades, and it's hard for me to imagine that after all of this time, we should be moving ahead. We should be progressing. Things should be getting better, and they've gone progressively worse, especially in the last 30 years or so. It's a calamity. It never should happen, but this is the way our government betrays us.
Yeah, well, they systematically took any controls. It started back in the 70s around the time of the McGovern presidential campaign, where they rooted and gutted out the representation function of the Democratic Party, which had links to trade unions and various constituency political pressure groups. And then you could control entire political parties. And once you could do that, you could get someone like Bill Clinton in there as candidate, the man who made his career sitting there as Attorney General, and then as Governor of Arkansas, closing his eyes while narco trafficantes came in from Colombia with airplanes, private airplanes loaded with cocaine into Mena Airport there in Arkansas, and U.S. intelligence authorities declared that a zone off limits. And Clinton, some of the state troopers in the Clinton administration testified to seeing bags of dollar bills or $100 bills put on the governor's desk, and no questions asked, no comments made. So that you know, that's what replaced the constituency politics of the traditional Democratic Party back in the 50s and the 60s when there still was some pressure from the base. And as long as you can break that link with the real constituents, then you have people who have a feeling of helplessness. And that's what they want. That's what they want.
So we have.
And I think it's a critical point right now. I want to stress this before we close, Stephen. I think it's at a critical point, both in Europe and especially in the United States, where people have the chance to turn this thing around. You can take a crisis and turn it into an opportunity, as the Chinese proverb puts it, if you decide to. And just as easy as it would be to stop this nonsense around AIG by blowing up the credit default swap and related derivative off over-the-counter markets, you could end this bailout of the Wall Street casino economy and get the real economy back on its feet.
We're out of time. I thank you for coming on. We're going to keep hammering on this. And absolutely, you have to come back and we have to continue this, because this is a long-running chapter, a lost decade ahead.